Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Outrage, violence in the streets of Minneapolis, and protests in many cities as a police officer is charged with murder in the death of George Floyd. Then, one-on-one, presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden joins me to discuss the events in Minneapolis and what they mean for all Americans. Plus, it's Friday. Mark Shields and David Brooks on Minneapolis, the pandemic, and leadership in a time of multiple crises. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The city of Minneapolis is bracing for a possible fourth straight night of violent protests. Outrage has echoed there and around the country since the death on Monday of George Floyd at the hands of police. President Trump threatened to send in the National Guard, if necessary, to bring Minneapolis under control. The white police officer who knelt on Floyd's neck as he gasped for breath was arrested today and charged with murder and manslaughter. Yamiche Alcindor begins our coverage.
A night full of nationwide protests amid a pandemic. From New York City to Columbus, Ohio, and Los Angeles. For the third straight day, throngs of people took to the streets, outraged by the death of George Floyd. On Monday, Minneapolis police arrested Floyd, who was black. While detaining him, a white police officer pinned him to the ground by his neck. Floyd could be heard saying, "I can't breathe.
I can't breathe. Please, the knee of my neck."
By the time an ambulance arrived, Floyd had no pulse. The four officers have been fired. And today, the officer who had his knee in Floyd's neck, Derek Chauvin, was arrested 4 days after Floyd's death. The Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman spoke this afternoon.
He has been charged with third-degree murder. We are in the process of continuing to review the evidence. There may be subsequent charges later. We entrust our police officers to use certain amounts of force to do their job, to protect us. They commit a criminal act if they use this force unreasonably.
Soon after, Floyd's family issued a statement. They said the arrest was a, quote, overdue step on the road to justice, but they added that the charges should be revised. They said, quote, "We want a first-degree murder charge, and we want to see other officers arrested. We call on authorities to revise the charges to reflect the true culpability of this officer." Last night on the streets of Minneapolis, there were chants of Floyd's dying words. Fury turned to scenes of chaos. National Guard troops were deployed to confront hundreds of protesters who flooded the streets. Some of the demonstrations turned violent. Looters smashed windows and rifled through stores. A police station was even torched after officers evacuated it during the chaos. Flames could still be seen rising above the building as a mass of people gathered in the street. Watching from Washington, President Trump took to Twitter, calling the protesters, quote, "thugs." He threatened military intervention, writing, quote, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." Twitter hid the tweet, saying it violated its rules, and then added a warning saying it glorified violence. The president blasted the social media company, and the White House's official Twitter account reposted President Trump's initial words.
Terrible event.
This afternoon, President Trump weighed in again.
I've asked that the Department of Justice expedite the federal investigation into his death and do it immediately, do it as quickly as absolutely possible. It's a local situation, but we're also making it into a federal situation, and it's a terrible thing. We all saw what we saw.
In Minneapolis, upheaval continued into the morning when Minnesota State Patrol arrested a CNN reporter on the scene.
Okay. Do you mind telling me why I'm under arrest, sir?
Omar Jimenez, who is black, was put in handcuffs after he identified himself as a journalist. He was later released. Buildings set afire last night still smoldered today. Daylight revealed the wreckage.
So many other friends, brothers, sisters, mothers,
Minnesota
fathers.
Governor Tim Walz acknowledged the protesters' frustration, but called for peace.
And now, generations of pain is manifesting itself in front of the world, and the world is watching. We have to restore order to our society before we can start addressing the issues.
Meanwhile, last night in Louisville, Kentucky, hundreds gathered in front of City Hall to protest a separate killing of a black person by police. In March, officers shot and killed emergency technician Breonna Taylor in her home. Some of the demonstrations turned violent. At least seven people were shot.
Many say the protests gripping the nation come from a deep pain borne by the African-American community as a result of widespread injustices.
Like it's a
Cheryl
moment
Eiffel
for
is
people,
the president of the NAACP Legal Defense
well,
Fund.
But obviously for us, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic and what our community has suffered, when you see that number, 100,000 dead, and how many of them are African-Americans, and when you see the years and years and decades of police violence against unarmed African-Americans, and the ways in which the justice system has failed us and the ways in which our lives have been diminished in this country, yes, it is powerful and heavy.
Today, former President Barack Obama also weighed in. In a statement, he said, quote, "It falls on all of us to work together to create a new normal in which the legacy of bigotry and unequal treatment no longer infects our institutions or our hearts." Back in Minnesota, the mayor of Minneapolis announced a curfew starting at 8 p.m. tonight. There and around the country, more protests are expected. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Yamiche Alcindor.
Late this afternoon, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Republican Lindsey Graham, announced that his committee will hold a hearing as soon as possible on police use of force in the wake of Floyd's death. Let's go back to the Twin Cities now and to our special correspondent there, Fred DeSam Lazaro. Fred has called that area home for four decades, and today he has been out in the Midway neighborhood. It's a place where there were protests, civil disobedience, and looting last night. I spoke with him just a short time ago. Hello, Fred DeSam Lazaro. So tell us about this Midway neighborhood of St. Paul where you've been reporting today. Tell us what you're seeing there.
At the moment, we're seeing a lull and a lot of cleanup duty. This is a neighborhood that's just east of the Minneapolis line, and in a community, a larger community that has really fretted the inequality between its white and non-white citizens, this is supposed to be a shining example of urban revitalization. There's a brand spanking new professional soccer stadium just in front of me. There are major department stores and grocery store chain stores here, all considered a vote of confidence in the vitality of this neighborhood. But more than anything else, there are hundreds of small businesses, most of them minority and immigrant owned, and at least 200 of them by the latest tally in St. Paul alone were damaged or total losses from last night's carnage. We visited this morning with Chun Park, an immigrant from Korea who owns a hip-hop clothing store. As he surveyed the damage this morning, we also caught him shooing away a looter who was rummaging through it. And here's what he had to say.
This business started about 20 plus years ago. I take over 13 years ago. If possible, I wanted to do again, because I see so many nice customers, so nice neighbors. So if possible, I wanted to do, reopen and live together with them. Sorry about that.
Well, you could see how affected he was, Fred. And you were telling us the business owners, many of them expressed anger and frustration that their businesses were not protected last night.
Indeed. Another criticism of police in general is that where they were present, they were protecting the assets of large companies like Target, and that certainly happened here. The police had a cordon around it, and it sustained no damage from yesterday. 200 businesses, including the one that's right behind me, a sporting goods store, were total losses. So that is a criticism indeed.
So Fred, as some of these people were cleaning up, they told you that they actually thought some of the looting was necessary. Explain that.
Well, I don't know if they said it was necessary, but rather understandable. There's a great deal of sympathy that one hears for the pent-up frustration that has built, especially in minority communities, about relations with the police. And so there's sort of a reconciliation that this had to happen, although not everybody likes the way that it turned out, but they keep insisting that this is not representative of the larger protest that has happened in this community. I talked to Peter Olafaso, who is a basketball coach and school counselor, this morning as he was volunteering.
I was around here yesterday, and a friend of mine owns a shop around the corner. So I was seeing all the devastation, and I just felt this was the best way that I can help. I mean, it's unfortunate seeing everything like this, but I feel it's something that had to happen. In a sense, people are frustrated. They feel voiceless. So, and I think initially, the protest, there's about 95% that are doing it for the right reasons. And there's 5% that took the opportunity and, you know, looted some stores.
So, Fred, overall, how would you say people there are processing what's happened? The arrest today of one of the police officers and the heightened police presence.
There is a real hope here, a palpable hope, that that will help de-escalate tension. And just in case, Minneapolis has declared a curfew starting 8 p.m. tonight. We'll see how this all turns out.
Fred DeSam Lazaro reporting for us from St. Paul, Minnesota. Fred, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Judy.
We want to thank our colleagues at Minnesota Public Radio for their help in our reporting today. The images we've seen this week of unrest in cities like Minneapolis resemble demonstrations that took place during the Obama administration, when protesters took to the streets demanding law enforcement officers face justice for their treatment of Black Americans. Joe Biden served as Barack Obama's vice president. He's currently the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, and he joins us now from his home in Wilmington, Delaware. Vice President Biden, thank you very much for talking with us. Now that this police officer has been arrested, thank you. He's been arrested, he's been charged with murder, third-degree murder, and with manslaughter. What happens now?
Well, what happens now is we find out what happens to the other police officers and whether or not the Justice Department decides to do a civil rights investigation as well. But what happens is we have to, I think, Judy, this is one of those moments, at least I hope it is, that is so vivid, so crass, so cruel, that so many people have seen, that it awakens them in a way to say, enough is enough. Our children saw this. Think of the millions of children who were just sitting by the television watching that cop smash the head of George against the curb and hold his knee there for 9 minutes. So I hope it awakens a sense of outrage on the part of the American people to hold police departments and all others accountable for their behaviors.
And yet, as we know, Vice President Biden, these incidents are not new. During the time you were in office, President Obama was in office, we saw Trayvon Martin. We saw a number of incidents with Black men in an encounter with police or with others. And I think Americans come away saying, we thought things were going to change. President Obama certainly spoke often and with passion, as you did. But here we are. It's 2020. It's still happening. What are people to believe now?
Well, terrible things still happen. But the frequency with which they happen, and an entire generation that's coming along, the young millennials all the way down through Generation Z, they're the least prejudiced, the least judgmental, the people who are most open to change. And I just think that, that what's happened is that coupled with the pandemic and watching how the institutional impediments that exist, both in racism and the way in which we deal with healthcare and a whole range of things, I think the American public's ready for us to do more. I think you're going to see a lot more pressure on police departments in terms of training. I think you're going to see many more people held accountable. Look how rapidly the police department acted here, and the chief and the mayor, in firing all three of them, and now a murder charge being brought. So I think that there is, we have to change. And it's going to take time. You have to have a president like Barack was who speaks out about it. You got to be able to talk about it. And if I'm elected president, this is going to be something that I'm not going to pretend is not happening. I think it matters what presidents say and how they say it and what they do.
Well, with all due respect, again, Vice President Biden, you had words similar to what you're saying today then. Certainly, President Obama did. What is going to be different? And is speaking, I want to ask you, is speaking out enough? What actions? There's been retraining in police departments, but still we see incidents like the one this week.
They have to just keep on it. We have to just keep going back at it. Look at the training programs. Make them stronger. Move on them. Look, I remember it's a little bit like, you know, when I was a kid, I came back from law school and my city had been burned down, 20% of it burned to the ground, occupied by the National Guard, and told that we were never going to be able to get any better. Things were just never going to change. Well, they changed considerably. The city, African-Americans and all others are integrated together now. Not totally, but there's a totally different circumstance than it was. So things have gotten, on a macro sense, better. But you still, if you're a black man or a black woman or a child, you're still going to walk worry when you walk out of the house, whether or not you're going to be the victim of what George was, you know, that because you're black, is still a grave concern. But the idea, it's not any better, I think, is, look, the other thing is, I'll just be very blunt with you. I think this president has stoked racism. From the time he made a moral equivalence between those folks coming out of the fields in Charlottesville carrying torches and their veins bulging and carrying Nazi flags and accompanied by white supremacists, and a woman, young girl gets killed, and he gets asked about it, he says there's a moral equivalence. They're good people on both sides. It matters what presidents say.
So finally, we see President Trump last night speaking about looting leads to shooting. Today, the White House is saying he didn't mean, he wasn't trying to threaten violence. What could you have done in the last day or so as president to prevent the kind of frustration and anger that spilled over in cities across the country?
I'm not sure I could prevent it, but I would not have heated it up. He didn't say, he said, they began to loot, we shoot. That's what he said, okay? And that's not a phrase that any president I would, that I think would make sense for a president to make, number one. Number two, I would have been on the air. I'm not saying it would have stopped it, but what I am saying is I would have spoken to it immediately. I did speak to it. I'm not president, but I did speak to it. We've got to make it clear that you're going to get to the bottom of this, that justice will be done. We're going to follow this through the end, that the Civil Rights Department and the Justice Department are going to intervene and determine what action can and should be taken if it's not taken by the state. And look, the difference between this and what happened in Missouri when we were there is the police chief immediately and the mayor immediately fired the three police officers and brought charges. So, you know, bad things are going to happen, and it's really frightening. You know, this is no time for incendiary tweets. There's no time to encourage violence. This is a national crisis, and we need real leadership. We need leadership to bring everyone to the table so we can root out these systematic racist activities that go on. And I'm not saying I guarantee you get it done, but you have to speak to it. You have to constantly be on it. You can't let up on it.
Vice President Joe Biden, we thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy.
And now, Amna Nawaz continues our conversation about some of the larger underlying issues surrounding all of this. It's part of our ongoing series, Race Matters.
Judy, it's been 4 days since George Floyd died in police custody. Since then, there have been peaceful protests, violent clashes, and persistent calls for justice. But those 4 days are about much more than just this incident. Joining me to talk about this is Eddie Glaude Jr. He's chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University, and he's the author of the book Begin Again. James Baldwin's America and its urgent lessons for our own. Eddie Glaude, welcome to the NewsHour. And let's just start with the news of today. It's been 4 days, as I mentioned. It took video documenting a man's death and days of protests, but the officer was arrested today. What's your reaction to that?
It's a great first step. It doesn't dispel the deep distrust we have seen before officers arrested or individual citizens arrested and the process of the judicial process taking place, and many of those same folks have been acquitted. So this is just the beginning. It could have been an easy step given what we saw on the video, but we don't want to overreach. You know, we always want to congratulate ourselves in these sorts of moments. We just need to understand this as the first, perhaps obvious step that should have been made 4 days ago.
We've also seen night after night of growing tensions, of people's frustrations coming out into the streets. The other piece of news today is the mayor announcing a curfew and a state of emergency. Is that the right move right now?
Well, you know, I'm not a mayor of a major city in the United States. I don't want to presume. But I do want to say this, though, is that anger is the anger that was expressed over the last few days, and especially last night, reflects, I think, a kind of accumulated grievance, you know? And in the way in which we tell the story of African-American politics, we always want to kind of bracket anger. We're not allowed to be angry in public. And in some ways, anger, going back to the ancients, going all the way back to Aristotle, announces that something just happened here. It puts folk on notice that something must change. And it's not just simply a spontaneous act. It is the consequence of, shall we say, as I said earlier, accumulated grievance. So there's a curfew. Folks will perhaps calm down, but we need to understand that anger, in this instance, rightly expressed, right, is the precondition for a general and, I think, appropriate correction of the underlying problems that define the life of Black folk in Minneapolis and in some ways across the country.
And of course, none of this is happening in a vacuum. You saw many of those protesters out there wearing masks. We can't forget all of this is unfolding on top of a health crisis, a pandemic that is disproportionately killing Black Americans. You wrote about that today. I just want to read you a short quote from that. And you said, "How does one live in such a time? For those African Americans who have lost loved ones and their jobs, who find themselves in long lines at food banks, who have to deal with the ongoing stress of a virus that can strike at any moment, how do you manage the trauma of loss and the terror of seeing another Black person killed by police?" Eddie, you use the word "another" because we have seen video after video. What is the collective impact of that, the cumulative toll of those videos?
Oh, my God. I mean, for those of us who have to watch it and then we have to worry about our children and our brothers and sisters and our uncles and aunts and our friends, right? It increases the levels of stress and worry and concern. You know, when we think about every major urban uprising in this country, bracketing 1968 after the murder and assassination of Dr. King, every last one of them have been rooted since 64, going back into the 1940s, in some form of encounter with police, some form of police brutality or some act in which the police have in some ways harmed or even murdered a Black person. So here we are in the moment in which we're dealing with a global pandemic, trying to figure out how to live under these conditions. And we still have to deal with the fact that our children, that our family members, that our friends can be murdered by the police. It makes living hard. It makes it difficult in a moment that's already difficult and hard.
We come back again and again to this question of when will it change? How will it change? I was speaking earlier with a police chief in a major city who was himself a Black man, and he said the frustration for him right now is that he said, "I don't know what else we can ask people of color to do. I don't know what else we can ask Black men to say or do that hasn't already been said or done." And until the people who aren't affected are as outraged as the people who are, nothing will change. Do you agree with that?
I understand it. I don't think we can wait on those who are invested in an idea of whiteness to change. If we do that, we're going to lose another generation. Those who are invested in an idea of America as a white nation in the vein of old Europe cling to those commitments. And in the in the interim, we keep losing people. Those of us who've learned the lessons of our history, those of us who want to imagine America differently, we have to start building a world where those kinds of beliefs have no quarter to breathe. Vice President Biden needed to say, what we need to do is hold police accountable. What we need to do is decriminalize, right? A whole host of actions that force these encounters. We need to change the way police see black men and women, right? Which is rooted in a deep cultural ethos. We need to address the fundamental underlying conditions of resource-deprived communities where people don't have a living wage, where they don't have decent education, where they don't have decent housing. All of this is rooted in this belief that America is a white nation. If we have to wait on those folk who are committed to that, America will continue to be this ugly place. So I believe in my heart of hearts that you and I and those of us who are committed to a more just America, a new America, we have to get about the business of building it now. COVID has changed everything, We can't go back to what was. We can't allow people to double down on their ugly commitments. We have to finally muster the courage to build a new America, or this thing will go to hell. That's a bit melodramatic, but
Eddie,
I hope you get the point.
I do indeed, and it was very well said, and I apologize we only have a few seconds left, but I have to ask you, because you shared in this essay that when you watched the video of George Floyd, that you wept, and you dig into the dark chapters of American history and spend your time making that truth very clear to the rest of the country and the world. What was it about this video and this moment that brought you to that moment?
He cried out for his mother. She's been dead for 2 years. She's been dead. He basically told someone to tell my kids that I love them because I'm going to die. And that man, that moral monster, kept his knee on his neck. I couldn't process it. It broke me.
It is Eddie Glaude Jr. weighing in at the end of a very difficult week for not just the family and friends of George Floyd, people of Minneapolis, and for the rest of the country. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Your PBS NewsHour podcast will be back in a moment. First, this message from our promotional partners at WNYC and PRX.
Whether you're a political junkie or just someone trying to make sense of the news, Politics with Amy Walter is the podcast for you. Each week, I go beyond the headlines to explore what's happening in Washington, explain why it matters, and demystify what it means for you. Politics with Amy Walter is a weekly podcast by The Takeaway from WNYC and PRX. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
In the day's other news, President Trump announced that the U.S. is terminating its relationship with the World Health Organization. Mr. Trump has accused the group of covering up China's role in the COVID-19 pandemic. The U.S. is the largest contributor to the WHO, giving about $450 million. Meanwhile, the number of confirmed U.S. coronavirus deaths topped 102,000 today. And the District of Columbia and parts of Maryland and Virginia lifted their shelter-in-place orders, as officials said the region was ready to begin reopening.
It's not a day of celebration. It's a day of being able to do some things slowly and on a limited basis that we haven't been able to do for 10 weeks. But it's not a party. And we shouldn't treat it like a party, or else we'll be back to square one.
As of today, there have been nearly 6 million confirmed coronavirus cases around the world. Russia reported its highest daily rise in COVID-19 deaths, 232. Meanwhile, India recorded nearly 7,500 new infections in the last 24 hours. It has now surpassed China in the number of confirmed reported cases and deaths. Even so, restrictions there are being lifted, and some businesses can now reopen.
We are wearing protective gears, including masks, hand gloves, and eyewear. We are taking all precautions. We are using sanitizer and giving only one towel to each customer and washing them after every use.
In France, officials announced the iconic Louvre Art Museum in Paris will reopen on July 6th. Visitors will be required to wear masks and to maintain social distancing. The Trump administration says that it is ending its special treatment for Hong Kong. That's in response to China's new security legislation in the territory and Beijing's handling of the COVID-19 outbreak. Pro-democracy advocates said that China's crackdown tightens the country's grip on the semi-autonomous city. The president denounced the new legislation this afternoon in the White House Rose Garden.
China has replaced its promised formula of one country, two systems, with one country, one system. My announcement today will affect the full range of agreements we have with Hong Kong, from our extradition treaty to our export controls on dual-use technologies and more, with few exceptions.
So for more on the president's announcement, I am joined by our Nick Schifrin. So, Nick, tell us the significance of what the White House is announcing.
Judy, I talked to experts on China on both sides of the aisle, and they acknowledge that the president's rhetoric was aggressive, but not as aggressive as it could have been, and not with as many specifics as there could have been to respond to Beijing's fundamentally altering Hong Kong's freedoms. So let's go through what the president announced. The first of four announcements was revoking Hong Kong's special status. As you said, what does that mean? That means visa-free travel. It means tariff-free trade. It means controls on exporting technology to Hong Kong. Number two, sanctioned senior Communist Party officials. Number three, blocking Chinese postgraduate students and researchers who have any connection to the Chinese military from entering the U.S. and possibly evicting postgrads who are already here with that same connection. And number four, warning travelers to Hong Kong that they can basically be surveilled electronically by Beijing. And as you said, in addition, the president withdrew from the World Health Organization and redirected the hundreds of millions of dollars that the U.S. sends to the WHO to other organizations and countries. He said the WHO is controlled by Beijing and didn't do enough to sound the alarm about the coronavirus. But critics say this is terrible timing during this pandemic to do this. Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican of Tennessee and chair the Senate Health Committee, saying tonight, I disagree. And also the American Medical Association saying this announcement, quote, makes finding a way out of this public health crisis dramatically more challenging.
And Nick, with regard to China, what's been happening there, how far does all this go toward actually changing the status of Hong Kong?
That is the key question tonight, Judy. As I said, according to the China experts I'm talking to, the rhetoric was aggressive, but question is, what are the actions? If the administration follows through, restricts travel, imposes tariff, that would be a fundamental shift in the status of Hong Kong. It would also accelerate a trend that's already begun to happen. Basically, Hong Kong becomes another Chinese city, and American businesses would have to make a decision of whether to stay and live under the Communist Party rules or leave the city. But the president didn't provide a time frame for that, nor did he provide a lot of specifics, only that he would start that process. And he also didn't do other options that some people had wanted him to do. He could have pulled out of the trade deal. He could have evicted more Chinese students who were in the U.S., and he could have sanctioned Chinese financial institutions. The experts I talked to say it's a tough balancing act between saving China, saving Hong Kong's special status, but also punishing Beijing. And they say this isn't enough to get Beijing to, for example, pull out of the trade deal, but it's also not going to stop Beijing from continuing to erode Hong Kong's freedoms, Judy.
Nick Schifrin following this very complex story. Nick, we thank you. And back in this country, Missouri's only abortion clinic will be allowed to remain open. A state arbiter ruled that the health department was wrong to deny a license renewal to the Planned Parenthood facility in St. Louis. Had it closed, Missouri would have become the first state in the nation without an abortion clinic since 1974. In economic news, U.S. consumer spending fell a record 13.6% in April as the COVID-19 pandemic forced businesses to close and lay off millions of workers. And stocks were mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 17 points to close at 25,383. The Nasdaq rose 121 points, and the S&P 500 added 14. Still to come on the NewsHour, Mark Shields and David Brooks break down America at a crossroads. Plus, we take a moment to remember some of the remarkable lives lost to COVID-19.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
And now we turn to the analysis of Shields and Brooks, that is syndicated columnist Mark Shields and New York Times columnist David Brooks. Hello to both of you. David, let's start with what Vice President Biden had to say this evening on the NewsHour in response to what's happened in Minneapolis. How do you read his message?
I was disappointed in it, to be honest. I think collectively we've had one of the worst weeks of our lives. 100,000 dead, an economy still in free fall, weird conspiracy theories in the beginning of the week against Joe Scarborough, a racist incident in Central Park, murder in Minneapolis. I want to see more outrage. I want to see outrage at a president who's grown more contemptible by the day, including his tweets about what happened in Minneapolis. I want to see somebody addressing the underlying issues that lead to the inequalities in places like Minneapolis and all around the country. I just want to see a more aggressive Democratic challenger who's really got broad arguments for collective change, structural change. I want to see a candidate who is as angry as he ought to be honest. And I understand he's trying to be moderate and trying not to whip up flames, and that's all to the good. He wants to win over swing voters. But this has been an exhausting and a terrible week. And I want to see a leader who can reflect what we've been living through.
Mark, what are you hearing? Is someone too moderate?
I agree with David. It's been a terrible week, a horrible week. But Judy, this is a presidential year. It's a political decision. American voters have a rather strange quirk which repeats itself. And that is when a president disappoints them, they go looking, quite frankly, for what was missing in that president, in his successor. And I think it's fair to say, as the only president in history who has never obtained a positive job rating from his fellow citizens, that Donald Trump has disappointed a lot of people. And I think what they're looking for is maturity. I think they're looking for restraint. I think they're looking for somebody who is a uniter and not a divider. I think that's what the job description that Joe Biden has to fill in 2020. What he had to say on the NewsHour tonight was thoughtful, was restrained, was mature. It was not stirring, as David was looking for. But I really think that the American people, the American voters, are looking for that maturity and that judgment in 2020.
David, what about that?
Yeah, it's a fair point. We want maturity. We don't want somebody who's going to go off crazy, but you can err on the other side. And I do think what this pandemic has done has exposed, as everyone keeps saying, the structural ravines in our society. And I do think there is a hunger for change and change of some significant nature. I'm conservative. I'm not for revolution, but I am for a comprehensive agenda. So that when the George Floyds of the world grow up in the Ward 3 of Houston, where he'd been living for so many years, and they're going to church every week and they're serving in their communities, spreading their faith, and then they go off to Minneapolis, they're not going off to a world of danger, and they're not living in Ward 3 Houston in a world of danger. And I just think, you know, changing the structure of those neighborhoods has to be on the agenda here, not just police training. And I'm sure Biden believes this. But I just think that it's got to be articulated.
It's a tall order, to put it mildly, to change so many of the things that we're talking about. Mark, how does a presidential candidate, I mean, there is a lot of understandable frustration, even anger on the part, not just in the African-American community, on the part of many Americans watching what's happened. What's the right way to express that?
Well, Judy, I mean, there is a legitimate, authentic outrage, and there should be. I mean, Mr. Floyd joins the ranks of Errol Garner and Freddie Gray and that of unarmed black men who died in police custody, and the fact that blacks die at a rate twice as high as whites on a per capita basis, police violence, the objectives of the recipients of police violence in this country is unacceptable. And the irony is, and it remains, that in these poorest of communities, which are often crime-ridden, there's a greater dependency on the police for safety. And the relations between the police and the black community in this country are important. And this obviously sabotages and undermines it. But I don't think there's any question that we're looking for healing rather than dividing. But remember this, Judy. We had the first black president in the history of the country elected twice, elected and reelected. And he was succeeded by the public address system of birtherism, a man who deals in theories that are so unacceptable and irrational, charging that his opponent, Republican opponent, Ted Cruz's father, who had fled Castro's Cuba, was involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. This is the political landscape in which we're dealing. And I think that's the harsh reality of 2020.
And not only that, David, coming back to what I think you said in your first comment about President Trump this week, not just in the comments last night about looting and shooting, but in other comments this week, Twitter instituted a new policy where they flagged some of the president's tweets, including one that had to do with Minneapolis. Are we sliding down a slippery slope here? I mean, can we come back from a place where we are now, where pretty much anything goes, not just in social media, but in public discourse?
We're at the bottom of some big mountain in the Alps. What Trump said about looting leads to shooting, he didn't make that up. That he got from a 1968 Miami police chief who was a law and order, let's get the thugs. And that's not an innocent phrase. That is a phrase that has a long history of brutality behind it. And so he went to that phrase fully knowing what it was going to lead to. And it follows a week, you know, I happened to be on Morning Joe on Tuesday when Mika Brzezinski read out this dignified letter from the widower of the young woman who died in Scarborough's office 19 years ago. And it was a man who was just trying to defend the dignity of his family against rumor mongering from the president. And I thought that was going to be the bottom of the week. And that was only the beginning of the week. And so what Twitter did to the tweet to mark it, but not eliminate it, to me is the right thing. I think people need to see what Donald Trump is doing. And I remain resolved that this country can be united around against racism. But marking it, because we should have standards. An internet platform has the ability to regulate what's on the platform and without having liability for it. And that's what the law says. And so I thought Twitter basically adopted the right policy, and the assault on Twitter, which the Trump administration seems to be trying to do, is an attempt to deny every platform's right to have standards of decency.
And Mark, this happens to be the platform that President Trump, I guess he has something like 80 some million followers. This is the platform he uses to communicate with his followers. When it was suggested this week that he just delete his account, the answer was no. This is the way I talk to the American people, to the world.
Well, not simply to communicate with his own followers, Judy. It's where the president announces appointments, announces firings, changes of policy, addresses the world. Donald Trump criticizing Twitter is like a whale criticizing the ocean. I mean, that's where he lives. That's where he thrives. And I don't think there's anybody can dispute that. I think the encouraging sign is the criticism of him, especially on the smearing of Joe Scarborough and the allegation of somehow he was involved in the death of a woman who died when he was 800 miles away, 1 month after he had announced his retirement from the House of Representatives. I think that the encouraging sign is when the Washington Examiner and the Wall Street Journal and even the New York Post tell the president, this is unacceptable. This is wrong. And even politically, I think you can see Liz Cheney, the number three Republican in the House, now twice has criticized the president, first for his attack on Marie Yovanovitch, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, in his tweets, and now in his tweets on Joe Scarborough, and saying this is wrong. And I can see that there is a political advantage seen by some Republicans anyway, to distance themselves from Donald Trump. And I'm encouraged.
Last thing I want to ask both of you, and that is, David, this is the week we marked 100,000 American lives lost in this pandemic, just in a matter of just a few weeks. I don't even know how to ask the question, but what is there to say at a moment like this?
Well, you know, we've had presidents who have led us through moments of national mourning, and they step out of politics and they uncloak themselves and they just become sufferers among a sea of sufferers. And that's what Barack Obama did after Sandy Hook. That's what Abraham Lincoln did after Gettysburg, George W. Bush after 9/11, Ronald Reagan after Challenger. They touch the sources of our culture. Robert Kennedy quoted Aeschylus after Martin Luther King was killed. Barack Obama sang Amazing Grace. They pick the things that unite us, and they broadcast it back to us. And it allows us to have the presence of a comforter, a presence of a leader. And the fact that Donald Trump didn't even have an Oval Office address, to me, remains mind-boggling. And so we're a country that has to walk through this hailstorm of Twitter at a time when we feel vulnerable because of what's happening all around us. And it's just an awful moment. I hate to be such a downer on a Friday evening, but this has been a bad week. I'm sorry.
And I hate to be bringing it up at the end of this week, but Mark, in about 20 seconds, how do you pull it together?
Well, Judy, I mean, this is a unique experience for America. Because those who are dying alone without the comfort of their family. Their families are deprived of the comforts of the rituals of wakes and funerals and memorial services and the company of friends and survivors who come to comfort them. That at a time when we really do need the voice, that leader who can speak to all of us and for all of us, that is missing. Sadly missing. David mentioned Robert Kennedy at Indianapolis in 1968. Full disclosure, I was working for him in that presidential campaign. And he said to those who were Black, to the Black audience when he announced the assassination of Martin Luther King, to those of you who seek violence, and understandably, I had a member of my family. For the first time, he spoke in public of the assassination of his brother, who was killed, and he was killed by a white man. And what America needs is compassion, and America needs love. And please go home and say a prayer for Martin Luther King's family and for the country. And that's what we need right now.
Mark Shields, David Brooks, we thank you both. As this week comes to a close, we want to take this moment again to honor some of the more than 100,000 Americans, as we've said, who've died of the coronavirus. Here are their stories. Anne Sullivan brought cartoons to life as a painter for animation studios, including Disney and Hanna-Barbera. Among the characters she helped create were the Smurfs. The North Dakota native loved to paint landscapes of the California coast and portraits of her children and grandchildren. Her daughter says Anne exuded positivity and that when she laughed, she did so with her whole body. Anne was 91 years old. Dosha Joy was colorful, his friends say. He had a smile and energy that could brighten a dark room. After aging out of foster care, Dosha, or DJ, fought to better the system, particularly for foster kids in the LGBTQ community. It was a mission that took him from his home state of Wisconsin to advocate on Capitol Hill. DJ was also a certified nursing assistant, studying to become a registered nurse. He was 28 years old. Corliss Henry was a trailblazer. She studied at New York's Harlem Hospital as part of the federal government's cadet nursing program in the 1940s and went on to work at the hospital. In 1957, she became the first black nurse on staff at Muhlenberg Hospital in Plainfield, New Jersey. Corliss was also a teachers' union representative and mother to Steve and Bruce. Her son says she was tough as nails, but incredibly loving. She was 95. Beverly Reap knew in sixth grade that she wanted to be a school teacher. For 39 years in her Arkansas classroom, she taught history to nearly 5,000 students. Beverly especially loved the American Revolution and led annual field trips to Virginia and Washington, D.C. The 63-year-old also loved to travel with her husband and son, Rob, who says she was his best friend. In 1939, 14-year-old David Torin fled Germany in one of the last evacuations of children from the country. He arrived in Sweden just 1 week before the Second World War broke out. He moved to New York in 1955, started a family, and became a successful patent lawyer. His son describes him as caring and bright. 75 years after evading the Holocaust, he recovered a family painting stolen by the Nazis, Max Liebermann's Two Riders on the Beach. David was 94. Finally, our Now Read This Book Club pick for May was The Street, a novel written in the 1940s by Anne Petrie, telling of a life of hardship for a young black woman in Harlem. Jeffrey Brown spoke about it with contemporary novelist Tayari Jones, and you can find their full conversation on our website and on our Now Read This Facebook page. Here's a short excerpt in which Jones explains why the novel continues to resonate today in a time of pandemic.
Well, I think this virus is really showing us all the fault lines in society. Someone told me that this virus is like luminol. Do you watch like kind of crime shows and they come into like a hotel room and it looks normal and they spray this chemical and when you turn out the lights, you can see where there's been blood and they turn out the lights and the whole room starts to glow and someone says, oh my God, it's a massacre. I think that this virus is like we have sprayed luminol on America and we're saying, oh my goodness, it's a massacre. This is where we are now. And The Street is a kind of novel that also shows us where the blood is in our society. And she's just, I feel that these characters are so alive and they touch our hearts, even the bad guys. I feel like she's asking us in our better selves to stop the tide. We have to take care of the poor.
That's Tayari Jones. The novel is The Street by Anne Petrie. And for June, we have selected a new thriller, American Spy by Lauren Wilkinson. You can find much more on that on our Facebook page for Now Read This, our book club partnership with the New York Times. And as we say goodnight at the end of this week, when, as we know, we've marked 100,000 deaths from the pandemic, we remember each of the lives taken from us, each one of the families in mourning. I'm Judy Woodruff. Thank you. Please stay safe and good night.